So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And I'm a stay-at-home dad and podcast, what do we say, devotee?
Devotee, yes,
practitioner.
There you go.
This will be my third podcast for this week that I've been on.
Oh, really?
That's right. I'm pulling a hat trick this week. I was interviewed by a Seattle-based podcast called Seattle Geekly about my work on Ask Lovecraft.
Well played.
And then I was back with our old friends at Miskatonic Musings to talk about Punky Brewster in the Pumpkinhead movie.
Wow. If our voices are seeming somewhat subdued today, it is that we have a tentatively napping child.
Yeah, we've been undergoing some nap difficulties over the last few days. We've dared to try to leave the house, leave the nest.
With her.
And she is punishing us severely for this hubris.
For disrupting what tiny, tiny fragment of a routine she was developing.
So
we crushed it.
We did crush it. So, but we are recording upstairs, which means that there should be marginally less Bilbo noise, which may actually be a detriment. People actually may come to prefer hearing Bilbo's thoughts and interjections on our show.
He is very opinionated.
So what has Amanda allowed you to do this week,
Rachel? I got out of the house twice now that you are staying home and I've not yet gone back to work. I got out of the house twice to hang out in our local coffee shops.
And you still decided to come back home?
I did. It was amazing.
You didn't just decide now was your moment
I started reading the Jim Henson biography, the new Jim Henson biography.
Oh, and how's that been treating you?
It's been very fascinating.
Because you've been sort of lugging that thing around. It's not a small book.
It is not a small book, and it is a very large book, and I'm only able to read it in tiny bits and start. So I definitely have been lugging it around and reading like two pages at a time.
Is it a fairly sort of straightforward, general kind of biography, or does it seem to be trying to like hit certain marks or make certain kind
of
points?
It's very chronological.
Okay.
I mean, it's very much early life and his early career and I guess sort of sowing seeds for later things.
Yeah.
But I'm only up to, we haven't even gotten to the Muppet Show yet.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He has concluded his original show, Sam and Friends.
Yes.
We have Ralph the dog.
Is Kermit
being introduced on the Jimmy Dean show? Kermit does not exist yet.
So Kermit hasn't been constructed from golf balls and his like grandmother's.
Well, no,
coat.
No. Like the prototype for Kermit exists.
Good.
The original prototype for Kermit was blue and was not a frog.
Ah, yes.
And was on Sam and Friends.
Yes.
So Kermit the Frog has not been the original success and fame of the Muppets was due to Ralph the dog.
Indeed.
Ralph.
Thanks to the Purina dog company, dog food
indeed,
company.
Indeed.
We were enjoying watching some of the first season with your family while they were here. Man, the first season's little like pop-up video, like trivia facts were so amazing.
I know. The first season of The Muppet Show on DVD is one of the best produced TV seasons on DVD. And then clearly they got really tired and didn't do it for the rest.
Well, it's really important because it explains to you who these weird celebrities from the 70s are.
Twiggy.
I'm like,
I remember Twiggy.
What's a Sandy Duncan?
Oh, I knew. See, I knew Sandy Duncan from the Hogan's Family.
Mm, yeah.
And I think she was the voice of something in The Fox and the Hound.
See, I don't think.
Oh, The Fox and the Hound, I would not be able to handle anymore.
I'm about to say, you're not gonna. You couldn't deal the like, Are You My Mother book.
Dude, I went back and read Are You My Mother to our child last night.
How did that work out?
And like, oh, the poor little birdie that's all lost with its snort and only by coincidence and happenstance gets placed back in its nest. But the tragedy that just lies latently waiting there.
Yeah, this child has done a number on Rachel's brain. I'm not going to lie to you.
I can't deal.
Although
anymore.
I'm not immune because I was one for this horror podcast. I watched the movie Pumpkinhead, and like the sort of inciting incident of it is Lance Hendrickson, like his son gets like killed in a car accident, and just watching him like trying to like take care of his son and like lugging his son around. It's just, I was like, I can't deal with this. This is too much. This is what has this daughter done to my poor brain?
Yeah. So unless you have anything else to report, the Jim Henson and the Muppets actually flows quite nicely into our theme for this week.
Pumpkinhead does not.
No, no. We thought it would be interesting to talk about the 6 to 60 type entertainment. The movies or TV or media that can be equally consumed and enjoyed from the youngest to the oldest members.
Well, and that is actually fun for the whole family and not just garbage that, like...
That parents are willing to sit through or that kids can just kind of...
Tolerate. Because there's a lot of sort of, like, lowest common denominator that you can, like, I guess we'll watch this.
Right, exactly. But that is actually so well done... That it hits multiple levels and each generation can enjoy it equally.
Yeah.
And like the Muppets are a great example of that.
That's really
true. I mean, a fantastic example of that.
Well, and I think the big thing that shows for that is that they've aged really well, right?
You know, except for all the dated references.
Well, all the dated references are very strange. Although it was really weird when the Muppets Tonight tried to like sort of make fun of their 70s origins.
Yeah.
And
you know what I discovered? Because I also watched the Elmo documentary, the documentary on the guy who does Elmo.
Oh, yeah?
Which is...
Kevin Risk?
Yes. Creepier now that he was alleged...
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Statutory rapist.
Yeah.
But he was Clifford, too.
So
he is the most beloved Muppet of the last 30 years and kind of the most reviled.
Clifford
was that horrible lobster-like thing.
Well, he was the weird, like, Jamaican felt monster.
Yes. I always thought he was a lobster.
I always feel like Pepe is the most reviled
Pepe
thing.
Was pretty bad. Pepe was a shrimp?
I guess.
I don't know.
Pepe is terrible. But yeah, no, on Muppets Night, they, like, were doing, like, the dating show or something like that. And so they were doing, like, 70s parody. But it was really broad 70s parody. And it's like, you guys were sort of from the 70s. Like,
it's true.
You could be like, hey, remember Joel Grey? We do, because we worked with him.
But it's interesting because it's part of what Jim Henson was striving to do was hit different levels, right?
Yeah.
Like, because he was doing, one of the things the book sort of alludes to, I haven't gotten to this part in his life, was how at some point he would be doing Sesame Street in the morning and The Muppet Show at night.
Oh, okay.
You know, and so something that was geared specifically for children and something that was striving to make Muppets, to show that puppets could be entertaining for adults as well as children.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of almost was part of his mission.
Muppets was prime time. Wasn't it?
Oh, The Muppet Show was prime time.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's definitely something that I mean, we talked about this in our marathon podcast. Kudos to anyone who actually listened to the entire thing.
Yeah.
Gold star. But this is one of the things we talked about. Like, I grew up with the Muppets. Everyone in my family, we loved and watched the Muppets.
Yeah, my Muppet exposure was mostly...
Your family doesn't strike me as Muppet people.
We were certainly Muppet friendly, but we had an LP of the album for the Muppet movie, which I listened to probably before I ever saw the Muppet movie. So, like, I knew all those songs really well, just because if we had an LP of it in Nigeria, we would probably listen to it 800 times. Please also see the Hobbit LP. Chipmunks sing the Beatles, which is how I like came to know the Beatles.
Oddly enough, the LP I remember most listening to when I was a child was Jimmy Stewart reading Winnie the Pooh stories. That's a whole different conversation.
True enough.
But I was like, aw, Piglet.
I remember you telling me about that. So Muppets were that. Muppet Babies, though, were the thing that I really grew up with.
Speaking of babies. We betrayed her. We'll be right back after these messages. And we're back.
All right, a woman comprised entirely of sneakers and striped stockings just came in to ask what all that racket was. We said, nothing, Nanny. And she turned right back around to await coming back at the end of the episode. So Muppet Babies was the show that I sort of mostly associated with Muppets, which is weird because, like, you come to know Skeeter as such a character, and then Skeeter is completely absent in the Muppetverse.
That's true.
Because she was made just to be like, oh, there's no
more
women.
Girls.
We can't have Janice. We can't have, like, a trippy...
Yeah.
A trippy rocker in this nursery. So we have Piggy, and I guess we'll have an athletic girl.
It's true.
To balance things out a bit. And then I had some exposure to Fraggle Rock, but not a whole heck of a lot.
I watched a lot of Fraggle Rock. But I think it's that maybe what worked in the Muppets was that it was so obscure and like, and this is again one of the things that comes up in the documentary or the biography I've been reading, it was that, you know, the high concept stuff that Jim Henson was doing, even in his very first Sam and Friends thing, which was really just Muppets lip-singing to songs.
Yeah.
That everything he did was very high concept and very sort of abstract and fairly surrealist. And I think adults appreciate that. Adults can get that on a deeper level. And for kids, it's just more crazy stuff.
It's just cool, yeah. No, that's the really funky stuff in the first season of The Muppet Show is all the weird, like, Czech shadow puppets. And
yeah.
Sort of like, what? This is bizarre. This is not... Because, yeah, The Muppets in recent years, in intervening decades, you know, I think sort of the Disneyfication of them have transformed them into a more staid, recognizable kind of thing, right? Like you would not expect to see something like that.
No, it's today. Very true. Well, or even something like The Dark Crystal or Labyrinth or...
Oh, gosh darn.
I mean, that was just so experimental.
Although I'm not a reality show fan, but I'm kind of excited about this Jim Henson reality show that's coming out.
Hosted by Gigi Edgley of Farscape.
Precisely. There's a nice Farscape connection. No, this is essentially, it's going to be like...
I'm torn as to what I think about it.
It's sort of like that runway kind
no,
of fashion
show. No, I know exactly
show.
What it is.
I can't remember its name right now.
I just know it's Jim Henson's Creature Shop is what I thought it was called.
Yeah, that sounds right.
But I, on the one hand, I'm like, it's Jim Henson Creature Shop. On the other hand, it's I feel like they have fallen to the reality show.
It is true. I would
monster.
I would prefer to see like a behind the scenes show about.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the workshop and how they create stuff. If this, however, like, you know, spurs on further interest in creating, you know, not necessarily Muppet puppetry stuff. I once heard a really fascinating interview on a different podcast. I think it was back when I listened to this all, like, nerd kind of podcast of gamers stuff and whatnot. And Nerdy Show, I believe it was called.
Hmm.
But they were interviewing puppeteers and people who had done like puppetry in movies for a long time. And one of the questions they asked was, what do you think is the most underrated puppetry movie?
Hmm.
And the answer really surprised me. And sadly, you have not yet seen this because of your protective upbringing. But it was Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh, yeah. I was totally not allowed to see that movie.
And I was like, wait, well, how is that a puppetry movie? But they explained, because with Who Framed Roger Rabbit... any of the scenes involving these you know pasted in animated characters, they still had to, if they interacted with an object, if they moved an object, that object had to physically move. And as they've said, we essentially were filming an Invisible Man movie.
Wow.
Where the set had to move, where props had to move, and so that was all done via puppetry. And that was really fascinating. I mean, that was, you know, that's as fascinating to me as when I first discovered that, you know, it was Jim Henson behind Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Star Wars, I mean, that's the thing that really got us started on this topic.
Oh, yeah.
We were sort of talking about how we both grew up with Star Wars, and Star Wars was this thing that really bridged all the levels in our family. I mean, I guess especially you and your brothers being 10 years apart in age.
Oh, yeah.
Something you could both enjoy.
Yeah, and it's something that's continued, you know, as much as whatever you want to say about the prequels. I mean, you know, Star Wars is still being watched by the, like, you know, children of friends of ours, and it's still something that belongs to an older generation, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's...
But I think of it as something that I enjoyed as a kid that was so definitive in my childhood. I think because I was just a teensy bit too young for Star Wars.
Okay.
But I had an older brother.
You're never too young for Star Wars.
Well, yes. But I mean, like, I was too young to go. Like, I remember when my brother and my cousins went to go see Return of the Jedi in the movie theater.
Yeah.
And I guess, man, there's no way I would have been 2 years old. At one point, they were out in the movie theaters. And...
Oh, yeah.
I remember my brother and older cousins going to see it and staying back at our grandma's house because I was too young to go. So I mean is, like, I was just too young to be part of that, like, Star Wars... generation, but my brother was.
Yeah,
and I kind of glommed onto it from there.
Yeah, because I mean, the first Star Wars movie was my middle brother Van. That was his first movie, and you know,
I
mean, that was, you know, definitely the first. I remember asking him, like, oh well, you know, when you saw it, you know, without knowing Empire, without knowing Return of the Jedi, like, what did you think Darth Vader was? What did you think the Stormtroopers were? And he's like, I think we just all thought they were robots.
So I remember, you know, those were my childhood movies. I watched the Trench Run of A New, like, I was too afraid to watch the movies all together because I was afraid of the aliens.
Yes.
But I would watch the Trench Run on our, like, the VHS that we taped off of TV. I would watch that over and over and over again. But my parents also loved them, right? Oh, yeah. They were also, and so what is it about something like Star Wars that does touch every generation?
Well, Star Wars is such a huge thing. And I'm enough of a slightly cynically minded person that I think it just reached a certain critical mass that it became part of the culture and became something that, you know, just everyone saw, so everyone could talk about and just was big and eventually becoming big because it was so big.
Right.
And I think there are some inherently good quality factors to it. I mean, if you watch other sci-fi movies from around that same time, you go, oh, right, Star Wars was somewhat better. Like, they just whatever their design team was, Lucas's camera work, everything, like, just clicked in very nicely. They created a really good world. And again, and a lot of it was just pure design. I mean, you go and you watch something like Crawl, which is, again, around the same time, and is trying to be this sort of weird, like, parts fantasy, parts sci-fi kind of thing. And it just looks cheap. And it feels sort of cheap. Mm. And the special effects are just kind of like, I don't know. So, I mean, Lucas definitely, like, just hit this sweet, sweet spot as far as creating a world that really stands up. It was fascinating. There was I think IO9 posted a link to a sort of mega clip of all the winners of the...
That was amazing.
Of the tech... What was the... It was the Oscar?
All the winners for best visual effects.
For the Academy
Awards. The first one being Star Wars.
And yeah, and so it's just... you start watching and you're like, it really is really great. And it's funny because it's like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and E.T. and then like some aliens gets like kind of like peppered in. But it's otherwise, it's just all Lucas and Spielberg.
Very true.
For like the first decade.
But I think, and you're going to kill me because you hate Joseph Campbell, but I mean, there is something in Star Wars that just touches, I mean, there's something that's beautifully simple in the story of Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
That it is, there is this sort of universal archetypal story at the heart of this series.
And I don't hate Joseph Campbell. I feel he can be overblown and I feel he can be sort of brought up to lend more credence that's necessarily deserved either to him or to whatever is he's being invoked for. I mean, I think Lucas lucked into
the hero's journey.
Well, he lucked into the hero's journey, but he also, I mean, because he was recreating, you know, Flash Gordon,
right?
And he was like, he was liberally borrowing from Kurosawa, Lucas was constrained in those early movies, right? He had a team that was working with him, that was bouncing ideas and was challenging him. You go back and you look at the original, like, Tale of the Wills, Luke Starkiller kind of stuff, and you're like, what? This is strange.
But they're not lightsabers. They're laser swords.
Yeah, precisely. It's very fun. I saw it when I went to go see the documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune. A big thesis of the film is this was a version of a Dune that was never made. It was produced. It had like a ton of money thrown into it. They did a ton of prep work and design work, essentially everything but film it. And then when it came time to like pitch it to studios, they made it this giant, beautiful, glossy book with all these designs and like pictures and like where it was going to go. And absolutely no one wanted to touch it because it just looked like this giant boondoggle. But you do look at it, and you do look at some of the storyboards and some of the scenarios, and you go, ooh, there's a little bit of Star Wars in this. You know, because, you know, especially all the desert stuff in it, a lot of those designs, you kind of look at it like, well, maybe Lucas just happened to, you know, like it was, it just happened to luck into it. But these design books were bouncing around Hollywood.
Wow.
Like all the major studios had access to them. So it's again, nothing provable, nothing actionable. But certainly when you look at it, you go, I wonder. And I want to say there was one of the storyboards they showed looked really suspiciously like the lightsaber fight between Darth Vader and...
Man, you go back and watch the lightsaber fight between Vader and Obi-Wan Kenobi, and you're like, wow, this is lame.
Well, it's steady, and it's measured, and it has...
They're stately and men of a particular age.
wailing on each other very slowly. Just, they hadn't got around to hiring, you know, frenetic Scott.
Well, that was also George Lucas's, like, these things are very heavy and you must handle them with two hands. And
yeah, well, they were borrowing from, yeah, to some degree. I mean, this sort of samurai dueling, yeah, you know, like, you know, those movies, which is kind of like, you know, whack, 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 stab.
Yes.
And then later they got a bit more wushu, and Ray Park showed up and was like, this is how you fight and make a mediocre movie seem barely watchable.
Right. So, what else?
Well, I was going through thinking about things that I shared with my family, and I feel like my particular story is probably not going to be useful, because, like, what did I watch with my family?
Well, Name of the Rose?
We watched Name of the Rose.
Mystery?
Well, that was the thing. Mystery was the thing that we watched a ton of. A, because it was the only thing I was allowed to watch during the middle of the week. So I very, like, associated it with my family. But, like, Murder, She Wrote, and I don't know why murder shows were considered appropriate. But I was watching Murder, She Wrote probably when I was from, like, the age of, like, 4 or 5 on.
So. I remember it being on. Like, my grandfather watched it. So whenever we were at my grandparents' house, like, I would sort of watch it sort of with him, or it'd be on in the same room. And my only association was, it's Angela Lansbury. She's the lady from Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I want to watch this.
Well, and that's what I, you know, those live action Disney movies, I feel.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, they may fall under the, like, well, they're, like, good enough, I guess we'll all watch it. But yeah,
I think that's in that weird camp of family entertainment.
Yeah.
Which is mostly geared to kids, but it's palatable for grown-ups.
Precisely.
And I think a lot of the Disney stuff falls in there, but it's not stuff that I think can be as equally enjoyed by grown-ups. But I will say this, that I think the best kid stuff is made to be really entertaining to adults.
Oh, sure.
And I think the stuff that goes over kids' heads is not, that's not a bad thing. Like, I remember in the animated Robin Hood, my favorite line in the animated Robin Hood is when Prince John is referring to Friar Tuck and he refers to him as the corpulent cleric. And I just love that. It just sounded cool to me. I didn't know what the word corpulent meant. I maybe knew what the word cleric meant. But
you weren't allowed to play enough Dungeons and Dragons.
No. It's true. But I think for the most part, a lot of the Disney stuff falls into can be fairly entertaining to adults, but is not made for adults and for kids in the way something like The Muppets or Star Wars or...
Well, and I think the animated movies for Disney did a lot better than a lot of their live action, like Fred Murray stuff. I mean,
or at least a lot of the later, something like Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin.
Well, I don't know. Even like, I'm thinking of, like, Sword in the Stone. Sword in the Stone had a lot of weird references to things.
Yes, that's true.
Allow Me to Bermuda. Like, as a kid, I was like, I guess Bermuda is a good place. But, like, yeah, you know, there were elements of it that really, and as you said, the
language,
the Robin Hood movie. Yeah, there was a language to it. They allowed themselves to kind of to be intelligent in certain ways, but still be really accessible and really fun. So a lot of those did well. Although I think, really, yeah, in modern day, you know, some ways they've tried to be a little cutesy, right? And a little precious, but I think, you know, Pixar is probably the greatest example of how Disney does that. How Disney can tell really fascinating stories that in many ways are just dark. I mean, and you know, we've discussed how, you know, Disney doesn't shy away from darkness. That can be a useful thing. But let's go and look into our own darkness of our infant daughter. We shall return. And we are back. But I do think it is a sense of peril in these things that helps. I mean, that's, you know, the Toy Story movies all have a sense of danger to them.
Well, what was interesting, there was an article recently about how the G rating is basically going away. And what used to be a G is now a PG rated movie, because we are so, like, parents are so afraid of their children seeing anything remotely scary.
Yeah.
Or anything like stuff that we, in animated features that we grew up with, would be rated PG today.
Well, and it's funny, because I remember when I worked in Blockbuster, on the back of the box, it would tell you, like, the rating of the movie and what it was rated for. Yeah. So, you know, rated R for nudity and violence or language. Or, you know, rated PG-13 for, you know, scenes of action. You know, like, they would get kind of vaguer and vaguer. But for PG, what was the most common word was, you know, rated PG for thematic elements.
Hmm.
which was this really strange euphemism that I never could quite parse out. And I would like watch these movies and be like, okay, what is the thematic element here? And the most I could come up with is like, parts are kind of scary, maybe.
Yeah.
But like, it was just this vague, like, why isn't this G? I don't know. Thematic elements.
Well, I guess this goes back to our podcast that we had about traumatizing children. But, you know, if grown-ups can be sufficiently entertained by things that are lighter and maybe more whimsical, children can be entertained by something that's darker. Children can deal with a degree of darkness and, well, all
the
and weight.
All the things we've talked about, you know, whether it's the lobotomy scene in the Muppet movie or the, you know, the trench run or like garbage smasher scene in Star Wars. I mean, just peril is, you know,
the poor lost little birdie and are you my mother?
That is not, no, that is not, that is, that not, is,
that is peril. That, is, that birdie is in trauma.
That birdie is fine. It befriends a giant, what is it befriend?
A snort.
What is it actually?
I don't know, some kind of like big garbage.
Smasher like, thing? I guess not the garbage smasher. They're on the detention level. but no, I mean, I do think that the things that stand up, A, that age well, and D, that don't have the sort of like the Fred Murray like want factor.
Yes.
Are, you know, things that have a degree of peril, you know, a certain amount of stakes. You know, Toy Story 3, that like, you know, that conclusion was chilling.
Intense, yeah.
You know, it was absolutely chilling. You know, The Incredibles, really, really good, fun, dark things. So that's why I think Pixar has really been the master. And we discussed that a bit when we were looking at kind of like decent kid stuff of, you know, of in our, you know, traumatizing children. I do think they do a really, really good job. Now, I haven't seen the Car movies, and I feel like I've missed a bunch of their more recent things.
I think the best example is Up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely danger in Up. The entire movie is peril, but there's also like real sadness and sorrow of life, right? There's just
that would affect people at different ages, right?
Exactly.
Like a kid would just be like, oh, this is sad, his wife is gone, you know, whereas, you know, I shudder to think what your reaction now, as bad as it was,
yeah,
you know, before we had a child, what you would feel about that 5-minute intro these days.
That's true. The other animated thing that I thought of when my family was here that is brilliantly multi-age appropriate is VeggieTales.
Oh, VeggieTales. Wow. Okay. Make your argument.
Barbara Manatee!
I agree that VeggieTales is fun. I feel like it may be fun specifically for teenagers in 1998.
Well, okay, yes. this was the conversation we got into with our Jewish friend who was bemoaning his toddler listening to VeggieTales on Facebook.
Not even a toddler, Rachel.
Oh, like five
a good a good school-aged boy.
Oh, okay. Never mind. But I was like, you can't really appreciate VeggieTales unless you were raised on like Superbook, and
Superbook
was even maybe one of the good ones when it came to Christian educational videos in like the 80s and 90s.
Well, we've talked before about the unfortunate kind of like parallel pop cultural track and how, because, you know, good Christian kids are a captive audience, you know, you can save on quality.
But VeggieTales came along and it was so clever, and it was so, again, much like we were talking about the Disney movies, clever wordplay.
Well, and they came out of puppet shows, right? So I have to imagine that they were very inspired by the sort of the allowed silliness of the Muppets and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. But like the whole, like, the fact that through these silly songs you had like a growing meta plot of Larry doing the Cebu song and getting yelled at by Dr. Archibald because the Cebu song was too silly, and then you had love songs with Mr. Lunt singing about his cheeseburger, and
it was good times.
And then Larry was brought back, and they managed to do an entire song out of a Chinese menu.
They did, and it was remarkable. No, I am not going to deny that there is a certain brilliance and mad brilliance to VeggieTales. I do, however, worry that they may not quite count as all ages. I feel like anyone too older than us will just view them as ridiculous. And,
yes.
And any child you present them to today will be mortified.
I guess that's true.
But there is something about that manatee.
Indeed. You have anything else you want to bring up before we get to
the big reveal?
Yes.
Well, because, yeah, when we were originally having this conversation, we were sort of trying to figure out, okay, what is the big multi-generational thing of now?
Because we're like, Star Wars, I mean, it's not like Star Wars is passé, and Star Wars, there's clearly going to be new Star Wars coming out in a few years. So I think Star Wars will always be there, but we're like, what's being produced today that has that same, like, cultural clout.
And is also slightly separate from just, you know, kind of geeks imprinting on their own children. Because I do think, like, comic books is another area, and comic movies and things like that are, you know, because these are these giant, big, you know, storylines that are being kind of, you know, passed on to younger generations. But Rachel realized that there was one particular area of pop culture that has fulfilled all these qualities and really is, like, really it just goes from like about 4 or 5 generations at this point.
Oh, which is Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I mean, in some way, it's interesting listening to Christopher Eccleston talk about why he took on the role of the Ninth Doctor.
Yeah.
Because he was talking about performing for children and how he liked performing for children and the things you get to do and the kind of manic energy you get to have when you're performing for children. And sort of for him, he almost saw it as a children's show. But it's...
Well, and prior to the reboot, there was that sense, right? It was, you know, the traditional viewing method of Doctor Who was behind your
couch, yes.
Yeah, behind your couch, sort of peeking out. You know, it was seen as this, like, you know, oh, it's really, really scary. You know, come on, you know, let's, you know, come on, Ma, come on, Dad, let me watch my Daleks.
Yeah.
And it sort of, it got rediscovered, I feel, by more folks our generation and, like, your straightforward, you know, BBC watching kind of geeks and things like that. But now, it really has spread out. Like, it is the thing that I see, like, so many of my mommy friends on Facebook posting about their kids being really into. Super listeners, the Kolars, talk about how when watching Wizard of Oz with their son and trying to explain who the Tin Woodsman was, it finally, like, clicked with him and he went, oh, he's a Cyberman. So it really is spreading like that. We were just having a conversation with one of my former managers at my bookstore, talking about having to console her infant daughter, her I think 3 or 4 year old daughter, because Matt Smith wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
And that, I think that speaks a lot, right? And that it'll be interesting to see where the show goes and how the show kind of maintains that pop cultural, like, level.
Yeah. So what is it about, we sort of talked about what it is about the Muppets, what it is about about Star Wars, what is it about Doctor Who you think that...
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, you know, my experience with Doctor Who is mostly the older stuff, which is just fun because it's ridiculous and cheesy and it's sort of like watching old Star Trek, right? Like, it's, you know, it's very repetitive, so there is a certain, like, you get to enjoy these sort of stories and these friends over and over and over again. When it comes to the new stuff, that's really your area of expertise.
Is it true? Well, I mean, I think it's that... Who's the guy? The talk show host. Irish dude.
Conan O'Brien?
No, not Irish.
Oh, Craig Ferguson.
Craig Ferguson. Yes, Irish.
Scottish?
Scottish.
One of them?
Some vague Celt or Gaelic.
Please don't send us letters. Or do.
We're the worst.
That'd be great. Craig Ferguson. I'm pretty sure he's Scottish.
Yes, Craig Ferguson. Did his little, like, Doctor Who sing-along thing, and there was the line about... proving that intellect and romance will triumph over brute force and cynicism.
Oh, yes.
And, I mean, I think there's something to that. There's a sort of optimism of Doctor Who. There's a sense of wonder with Doctor Who. There's a zaniness.
Well, and he usually comes across as a defender of an underdog.
Yeah.
Which is big. And he despite the fact that he obviously always triumphs, he somehow manages to kind of position things so it looks like he's in position of weaknesses.
Yeah.
Of position of weakness, you know, and before overcoming it. So I do think that's a big part of it. And it's just it's flashy, and yeah, that lack of cynicism I think does help. Because kids can sort of, you know, key into that pretty well.
But I think it's good. I think in some ways that sort of thing, like the Muppets, like Doctor Who, these just zany, wacky things are, I think, healthy for us as grown-ups as well, right? Everything doesn't have to be Mad Men or Breaking Bad.
Very true.
Like,
although Amanda really likes both Mad Men and Breaking Bad.
It's true. And The Walking Dead.
She just likes that guy who is also in love, actually.
But everything doesn't have to be these dark, brooding, angsty drama. I mean, there's a place for that. And I think that we should, you know, it's important to have avenues to explore mature, more sophisticated themes and to explore the darker aspects of human nature. Well, like, again, even from a Christian perspective, right? I think that there, you know, everything doesn't have to be just clean and wholesome, because that's not an honest,
well, again,
investigation of humanity.
And again, there's a difference between there being peril, there's a difference between there being danger, and then there being bleakness.
Right.
And there being a sort of a lack of hope. And this is a point that I've brought up a time or two, which is that I think kids respond very well to seeing danger, and kids respond very well to seeing peril, but they don't deal well with hopelessness.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like a sort of like a sense of, no, the bad guys will always win. Good night. I think that's the difference there. And so, the worst kind of pandering kid stuff just, you know, chooses not to, you know, engage
with this at all.
And then when it tries to then also engage with adults, that comes across as yeah, shallow or just...
Well, and it engages with adults by making some kind of off-color reference that children won't understand as like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge to adults.
Although Animaniacs was pretty brilliant.
Well, Animaniacs was fantastic, but...
that was the entirety of their writing.
But they reveled in it. They embraced it. It was like...
They were doing their best to essentially make kids have to turn to parents and say, what do they mean?
Yeah.
Why did they say that word again? That's that's the clue that they just said a dirty thing. Really, though.
Well, I guess you can... we are sort of wrapping up, but I mean, that takes us into Looney Tunes, Bugs Bunny territory.
Well, and that's... that's an area that has really...
But I feel like
well,
that's a different thing where it's almost like kids and adults are enjoying something different about it, right?
Yeah.
There's something different about Bugs Bunny or even Animaniacs that kids are getting out of it and adults are getting something totally different out of it.
Precisely.
I think what's interesting about, like, The Muppets or Star Wars or Indiana Jones or... Doctor Who, or a lot of the things that we've talked about, is that kids and adults are somehow enjoying the same things.
That is very true. That's very different from the sort of the sly winking, like, yeah, ha ha ha, ask your parents.
So there's a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
Bugs Bunny stuff is classic, but it is a very different thing than what I think we're talking about.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see going forward what keeps that. Like, you know, we're looking down at Amanda. We're sort of curious what horrible things is she going to force us to watch, right? You know, My Little Pony does seem to be the big weird thing that's crossing all sorts of strange generational divides. But for reasons I don't even want to get into.
Let's not talk about bronies. I don't want
to. But a children's show that we have discovered that I think we would love to see more things in the vein of are things like Phineas and Ferb.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or, this is like a decade old reference, but Fillmore. Fillmore was a great show that was, an animated kids procedural crime drama that would make Silence of the Lambs references. So I'm very hopeful for where things are going. There's a show out called Adventure Time, which is another one of these shows that I see really referenced across the board by both, like, just my gay childless hipster friends and like my mommies, you know, yeah, on Facebook. Like every, you know, there's just people are really into it and really enjoying it. And it is incredibly just like earnestly fun, right? It's wacky and strange. And there are like D&D jokes being thrown around, but it's also just a weird, fun world. It's not just SpongeBob. So I have a lot of hope. And so it'll be very exciting to see just what happens. But I am also... I'm expecting that we're gonna have to buy whatever the 2020 equivalent of Jim and the Hologram action figures are for Amanda.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, we're gonna be taking you all out with a Debs and Errol song from off their new CD, Control Alt Duets. And this one, given that I knew we were gonna be discussing Disney.
Amanda is starting to talk. She might want to say something.
Do you have things you want to share? Oh, she just really likes Debs and Errol. She supports their work. This would be A Virtual World, which is their parody of A Whole New World. So do enjoy from the world of faith, family, and fandom in no particular order. This has been Geekily Yoked. Geek out, y'all.
I can show you a world shiny, pixely, splendid. Tell me, princess, now when did you last love the game you played? I can open your eyes. 3D graphics are wonder. Watch me as I fight and plunder. When I do this raid, a virtual world with many different camera views. You get to play a role, maybe taunt a troll. It's really not demeaning.
A virtual world, it's baffling. This is what you choose. Now that I see it here, it's crystal clear. I won't go to this virtual world with
it's
you.
It's not so bad, just look what you can do.
Unbelievable time wasted here. I am reeling as you sit.
Where?